I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time now is 9:01, and on Mondays, that means it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgeridge, your host for today, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. The mole is the beast that works underground, digging away at the hidden roots of this society and bringing back weekly reports on what happens below the glitzy and shallow surfaces presented to us by the mass media. The work of the mole has never been more important. Here's what we have for you today. Demonstrations against what Donald Trump and company seem likely to do have already been underway around the nation as well as here in Portland. So we will be hearing from civil rights attorney Ashley Albies of the National Lawyers Guild about what they will be doing to defend the right to protest and to challenge harsh treatment of protesters by police and jailers. One of the most powerful protests has been the community of people gathered at Standing Rock in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we'll be hearing parts of a keynote speech by the chairman of the Yakima Tribal Council in response to the recent decision by the Army not to permit drilling under the Missouri River, at least for now. We will also be hearing from psychoanalyst Lynn Layton about efforts to get the American Psychological Association to apologize to indigenous peoples for the long history of oppressive treatment in mental health facilities.
And I'll have a commentary
drawing from today's and last week's show about how the left needs to organize to face the challenges ahead in the light of the election of Donald Trump. We'll also be hearing some excerpts from the song Todos Somos Ilegales, or We Are All Illegals, by the New York band The Outer Nationals. It's a bilingual song about the border, the USA, and the system that criminalizes those who create the wealth it rests upon. It asks us to ponder the relationship of our common humanity to a system of laws that has permitted the seizure of the land from the people who lived on it, and the definition of millions of us as illegal. And here now is the Old Mole's Bill Resnick to talk with Ashley Albies of the National Lawyers Guild.
Ashley Albies, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
Ashley is a local attorney, recently chair of the National Lawyers Guild, a long tenure for 8 years, done a lot of work. Ashley's done a lot of pro bono work for civil rights, civil liberties. She's the attorney now, for example, the Albina Ministerial Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Ashley, tell us about the National Lawyers Guild in Portland, the kinds of work you do, and then we can discuss what's likely to happen in the near future in the Trump presidency, as he apparently is ready to carry on and intensify a lot of oppressive policies that have been developing for the last 30 years with regard to dissent.
So the National Lawyers Guild is a national legal organization made up of law students, legal workers, lawyers, and jailhouse lawyers.
And jailhouse lawyers.
And jailhouse lawyers.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in our Constitution, it states that we practice law and we use the law, and we strongly believe that human rights are more sacred than property interests. And so at the national level, we have chapters all over the country. We have annual conventions. Here in Portland, we've had a pretty strong chapter for the past couple decades. Currently, we provide legal observers, folks with green hats out at mass demonstrations that monitor the conduct of the police and document the police response to mass demonstrations, and then provide legal support to individuals who have been arrested during those demonstrations. It's called the Protester Project and the Legal Observer Program. And we have a core group of really strong legal observers who have been out on the streets in all kinds of conditions to provide that support for the demonstrators. We're all volunteer groups, so many of our members provide support for folks who are challenging their arrests or have filed complaints with the Independent Police Review Division through the city's program of the IPR process. And historically, we've provided support for folks who have gone through the Citizen Review Committee appealing that IPR decision. We've provided legal support to Right to Dream 2, challenging the fines that were imposed on them by the city. We've had folks in our organization work with people on housing and housing justice issues, work with labor unions on organizing projects and supporting labor unions. We have members who've provided legal support to immigration, folks that are organizing around immigration and detention and the mass deportations that took place under Obama and are going to continue under Trump. We have folks doing all sorts of progressive and movement supportive legal work in the community.
Just to add to a few that I know about, my understanding is that the National Lawyers did a lot of work trying to stop the police from illegal surveillance over, starting quite a while ago with the Red Squad. There was a Red Squad
yes.
in Portland, and
yeah, absolutely.
They've had to give up a lot of their materials, but
right.
they still seem to be
right.
trying to do some of the same stuff.
Right. The Portland chapter has been involved in police oversight, whether it be policy work or stakeholder groups that work on police reform efforts. We oppose the Joint Terrorism Task Force when it was first proposed. Each time it comes up, we work on those issues as well. Have been active in opposing mass surveillance and using surveillance tactics and over-policing as a means of targeting communities.
Right. And the gang enforcement mm-hmm. abuses.
That's a major issue. I mean, I don't know that the NLG specifically, I mean, there's criminal defense lawyers who have been addressing that, and there's organizations that are working on those issues. The legal framework is, there have been challenges. For example, there was the Oregonian just did some coverage on the gang enforcement team and how one gets designated as a gang member or gang member affiliate. And there was a legal challenge to originally how they first started putting people on those lists. So they changed up the way that they provide that designation. Now they give people notice and an opportunity to challenge it. Whether that's sufficient, I think, is a different question.
Yeah, what about the stop and frisk stuff now, this very, very aggressive policing, which they really do in, quote, minority neighborhoods and with kids who wear hoodies,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me. They're very, very aggressive. Are you involved in that stuff in Portland now?
Well, I've heard from people. I have clients who have experienced a lot more police attention, and it appears based on the color of their skin. Most of my black male clients, I also do a lot of employment discrimination litigation.
But
many of my clients, if I'm representing them for reasons not related to police interaction, describe having been pulled over multiple times by police officers, describe having been searched by police officers, despite there not being any apparent justification for that. So I think those issues are present and prevalent in Portland. The Portland Police Bureau's own collection of their stop and search data reflects that they are disproportionately stopping people of color and searching people of color, and that's been true for decades, or for as long as they've been collecting that information.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here. I'm talking to Ashley Albies, who is the chair of the, still doing a lot of the administrative work for the Portland chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. They've been involved over the years in nearly every effort to maintain civil liberties in this city in one way or another. Ashley, let's talk about the recent past, the gradual narrowing and the attack on dissent, the attack on protests, the effort to suppress protests that's really been going on more and more intensely, starting with the, it seems to me, even before the year 2000, with their free speech zones and efforts to curtail dissents to make it more dangerous to preemptively arrest people mm-hmm. just to sort of to make life difficult for protesters and chill civil liberties. If there's a real good chance of you being arrested and held for days, the New York police are the worst, but they do it all over the country.
Yeah.
It makes people think, well, maybe I shouldn't go to this protest. I have an appointment at the doctor the next week or whatever it is. It's very inconvenient to be arrested and held for a long time and expensive, too. They're doing more and more of it, it seems to me. Tell us about your sense of the trends, even through the Obama administration, also of heavy surveillance, all of the rest of it, super cops, FBI entrapment.
There's a lot there.
And militarization
right.
of the police. But it seems to me that Trump is probably going to intensify all of this, but Why don't we go through the list of the stuff that he's likely to intensify?
I mean, the tools already exist, and that is a product of the last several presidential administrations, Democratic or Republican. There's this free speech zone practice that has cropped up in the past couple decades in response to the 90s, which is when I first began attending protests, and I didn't go to law school until the early 2000s. But even back then, there were these cordoning off spaces for demonstrators, for mass demonstrations, for demonstrators to kind of get trapped in these spaces. And under the First Amendment, Supreme Court has upheld these what's called the reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, that the government can put certain restrictions on demonstrations and on the expression under the First Amendment. Whether those restrictions are reasonable is a different question, and what that means. And there's a sentiment among folks that engage in demonstrations and folks that support the First Amendment and a bold and robust First Amendment practice is that cordoning off people into these, quote, free speech zones where sometimes they're miles away, like at the political conventions where they nominate their presidential candidates every 4 years, there's been the practice of sending folks into these free speech zones that are far away from the delegates and far away from the folks that these demonstrators seek to impact by their presence.
Well, in Portland, they did a free speech zone near the airport, as I recall, in a area that was cordoned off with not only fences, but barbed wire on the top of the fence. Once you get into your free speech zone, it could be a concentration camp zone, the way they've in fact done the structuring of it.
Right. So these reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions are a construct of the court, right? There's nothing in the First Amendment that says anything about reasonable time, place, and manner, although folks can agree that some limitation might be reasonable given how the court has framed it as a, quote, legitimate government concern. And so if the government concern is that they don't want to be bothered by dissenting voices, many would argue, including myself, that that is not a legitimate governmental concern, and that the very purpose of First Amendment activities, especially mass demonstrations, is to show the government that you disagree with the course of conduct that they're taking. So to cordon people off or to send people into a less visible area completely undermines the purpose of those demonstrations.
Or to demand that people, before they even schedule a demonstration,
get a permit.
But where you, in fact, have to follow their guidelines, and where they get angry and then mass in these RoboCop uniforms. In Portland, we sort of faced them down in the year 2000, and they had to change their tactics some, partly because there were photographs of what they were doing at the time, especially the horse patrols. It was really egregious what they did, actually, in that demonstration.
Right, and in
herding people against the river with these motorcycle things.
In subsequent demonstrations, like when George Bush was here, and what was that, 2004? I can't remember actually what year it was. It might have been earlier than that. The Iraq War protests, and when there was a tremendous amount of force used against individuals, and there was a lawsuit that arose out of that, that Alan Graf, who was a former attorney here in Portland that litigated that case along with Stu Sugarman and several other folks as well. Myself and my colleague Shauna Kerfey had authored a recommendation report several years ago arguing that non-permitted protests should be treated just like permitted protests, and that when it comes to pepper spray and use of horses and use of that type of weaponry, that that should be very, very substantially curtailed and limited, especially when you have mass demonstrations where children are going to be there, people with compromised immune systems should have the right to take the streets and feel safe engaging in First Amendment protected activity without fear of being pepper sprayed or fear of having their health threatened by doing that.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Ashley Albius, who's a local attorney, was the chair of the National Lawyers Guild for a long time, and is still working with all of the lawyers and doing a lot of administrative work and doing cases and representing clients like the Albina Ministerial Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Very active. Ashley, the Trump administration is very likely to, in fact, what we're seeing now in the Dakota Access Pipeline case, get very, very aggressive, and even at the beginning, to show people that they will not accept anything. And lawyers are only part of the story. In fact, that heavy policing and the efforts to destroy and discourage and make people fearful of dissenting. Previous administrations have done it too and been met with real strong response and resistance. I think it's going to have to happen again. I'm sure the lawyers are prepared. I mean, there's been so many precedents, and there's a lot of people. I think the movements are going to also have to really step up to the plate. There's millions of people who Trump is a minority president, incidentally. People really don't like him or know him, even some who voted for him, out of resentment of previous elites who've done nothing for them. It will be possible to really challenge them. And my guess is they are not ready to fire guns at people, which would be a real terrible thing. Right. Kent State was a disaster for the government, a complete disaster when they did fire some guns. They're going to be fairly, it seems to me, restrained in that. We really do have to be talking about movements. Right. The law is not going to protect us unless the movements are really strong and really threaten the popularity and the control that the oppressive forces are trying to get people to submit to.
Right. I mean, as we've seen in the past few years with the Black Lives Matter movement, of people taking to the streets and expressing their outrage, expressing their resistance, and there is power in those numbers in conjunction with the Black Lives Matter movement being at the forefront of racial justice movement work, we've seen the increased militarization response. And these local police jurisdictions are not paying for those weapons themselves. Those are being given to them by the federal government. And that occurred under the Obama administration. That occurred under the Bush administration. It occurred under the Clinton administration. We've seen it accelerate in the past couple administrations. But I think that's an important point to remember, is that even though these local police officers, sheriff's departments, or local police departments are the ones that are responding to these local demonstrations, they are getting support from the federal government. And in Oregon here, we have some of the things that Trump is going to do. There's a whole list of things that he's expressed an intent to do, such as targeting our immigrant community members for deportation at an alarming rate and an alarming number. Here in Oregon, we have this statute that states that local law enforcement and state law enforcement are specifically directed not to enforce immigration law. I think we have some protections that are unique to Oregon, and that there are laws and there are strategies that activists, organizers, lawyers can use to resist the kind of federalization of our local law enforcement to enforce Trump's agenda. And we need to be clear on those things and make sure that our elected leaders are making the right choices to protect all of us in the state and all of our community members in the state, regardless of their legal status. And I think the focus needs to be on using those opportunities to push back against the repressive system, to remind elected leaders that control our local government, our local instrumentalities of government, being the police, the police bureaus and the sheriff's departments, from targeting individuals that are more vulnerable. Not to say they should be targeting other individuals who are not as vulnerable, but I think there are strategies that people can use and organizations can use and organizers can use and everyday people can use to build solidarity with each other, to push back. And that's what people need to be doing. The lawyer part of that is to assist people in getting out of jail if they're arrested, or to bring civil action if they're harmed or if their First Amendment rights are infringed. But it takes coordination and it takes everybody working together to have a united front, so to speak, to make sure that we're all supporting each other in doing this type of work.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. In fact, there are real possibilities of going on the offensive. Mm-hmm. I don't think we want to remain on the defense. We want to go on the offensive, particularly on things like prison reform or the way they treat arrestees and the mass incarceration that we're having now, and the destruction of minority communities by holding and incarcerating this enormous number of people, white and black, actually, but the black working class is getting it the worst. Right. It seems to me there's a strong majority for changing a lot of that, even within amongst some people who voted for Trump. And again, he was a minority president. Mm-hmm. I think we can build upon those challenges, all kinds of challenges to undemocratic authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunities here. If you look at the disparities in Multnomah County with regard to policing and incarceration, those exist here just as they do everywhere else. And there are a lot of incredibly passionate, well-organized, smart people working to decreasing those disparities and to make sure that everybody's safe and everybody's protected and treated more equally in the way that charging decisions are made, the way that arrests occur, the way that sentencing happens, all those things.
Yeah, all the movements of every kind, they all have an interest of stopping this oppression of dissent of many kinds that go on. And I think everybody understands it, too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interests and there's a lot of work to be done. And I think the opportunities to support each other are there and they're present at all times. And there's what has been very effective in Portland and also just incredibly inspiring is to see the way that community groups and advocacy groups come together and work in solidarity and work to support each other. Something that came up just last week in front of the city council was the socially responsible investment recommendations, which was to divest from banks like Wells Fargo that support private prison industries, support Caterpillar that supports occupation and is providing the means by which the Dakota Access Pipeline is going to be dug. So there are a lot of opportunities, not just legal and not just in the streets, but political as well, that policy work that people can be doing and pushing for those changes at the local level. Because the Trump, as we know, the Trump administration is going to come down hard in so many ways. Immigration, Trump gets to put forth an attorney general, of course, but also set priorities for the Department of Justice. We know that he's not likely going to be pushing the civil rights agenda that was advanced under Obama, and that has impacts in education. It has impacts in the criminal legal system. It has far-ranging impacts, and folks have to work together at a local level to push back against that, to support each other in pushing back against that.
Ashley Albies, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work with the National Lawyers Guild and others. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
We're all illegal, the defiant ones. Our time has come. We're all illegal, fighting for a new way and a new day. Music from Outer National and their album Todos Somos Ilegales. What happens when the state falls into the hands of the lawless? Who's illegal then? Before the music, we heard Bill Resnick talking with civil rights attorney Ashley Albies about the challenges facing lawyers defending protesters and the right to protest. Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, I'm Clayton Margaridge. Well, on December 4th, word came down of the Army Corps' denial of the permit for Energy Transfer Partners to drill under the Missouri River by the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota. Field Mole Desiree Helligers was on hand at a Vancouver, Washington fundraiser for Standing Rock, where the keynote speaker, Jode Gowdy, chairman of the Yakima Tribal Council, spoke about the connections between the historic struggle at Standing Rock and the ongoing battle to protect the Pacific Northwest and Columbia River from the predations of fossil fuel companies bent on profit at any cost.
Thank you very much, Cecilia. Sheikh Khawri Baninaimuma, Banashas Chaikwach, Anakuchikuk Nayakushanak Panitashwabata, Ami Sinwita, Iwan Nakatawitash, Ach, and then Waitwitwanitash, Iwan Nakatawitash, Ami Chush, Ami Ninaimuma, Ami Yalchima, Nami Anishma. My name is Chaikwach. That's my native name. And I'm also known as Jode Gowdy. And I serve as the chairman of the Yakima Nation Tribal Council. And as Cecilia had indicated, and I want to thank each and everyone here this evening for the opportunity to express some words on behalf of what is happening at Standing Rock, what is happening there with their fight on behalf of their chush, their water, their kichum, their land, their elders, their children, their future. It is not unfamiliar to many of us, specific, but what is unique about the Standing Rock situation is that it has awakened many hearts, minds, and spirits specific to a plight and questions. First question I must ask myself is, Shinawanisha, who are you? Who are you? The second question is, Manaknikanwa, where do you come from? And those are two, what most people would observe, very, very simple questions. But if anybody truly took the time to have an understanding of where those questions are coming from, what they're doing, how you are coming into interaction with those questions, and where you are taking it. Because it's only upon the understanding of such questions, who you are and where you come from, that you have the foundation necessary to put conscientious and clear, coherent thought into where you are going. The answers to those questions for me, they've changed throughout time. To have an understanding of who you are and where you come from, because I, as a native person, I can tell you that my ancestors walked upon this very ground that I'm speaking at tonight. We have a tie physically throughout history that goes back with this territory and this area that goes back since time immemorial. Regardless of what anybody says to our people collectively, that means forever to us. Me as a Yakima, for me as a native person, for me as a person who has a relationship with that Enchiwana, that river that flows by us, to have a relationship with those things that separate you and your identity from the rest of this world. And without such things, you cease to be. We have a relationship with our language, first and foremost. We have a relationship with our chush, our water, which many of you are drinking. We have a relationship with our lakanish, our salmon, our teachi, our chaush, our lush, our roots, our winet, our deer, our mavokia, wapanish, our elk, our timush, our weewinu, the chokecherry, and the huckleberry. But above all, for the native peoples of these lands, of these territories, we hold chush to be in high regard, water. The chairman of the Yakima Nation, I have a duty to uphold the Treaty of 1855 between the Yakimas and the United States. The federal court system is a rigged system when it comes to Native issues. If you go back to the origins of federal Indian law, what you're going to find is Justice Marshall in the Marshall Trilogy, but specifically one case in Johnson v. McIntosh, citing historical Roman papal bulls for his justification to rule on jurisdictional issues for land when it comes to Native involvement. And you go back to the papal bulls that he cited, and what you have is papal bulls that were issued by the popes who sat in the 14th and 15th century that gave holy orders to the monarchs of England, Spain, and Portugal. And this is what Christopher Columbus, or Cristobal Colón, utilized when he arrived down in Honduras. He had papal bull in hand, and what it stated was that as they had gone out to glorify the crowns of their various monarchs, that if they came upon unclaimed lands, and our lands occupied by heathens and our savages, that they had the right to express dominion over those lands and those peoples. Dominion as in domination and dehumanization. Those things happened. They were utilized as holy orders. Those holy orders were put as justification to essentially invoke and conduct the greatest genocidal act in the known history of man. I'm a survivor, my people, our peoples collectively, the greatest genocidal act in the known history of man. That's reality. Funny how that plays out when you get into the Supreme Court rulings and you have a Supreme Court Justice John Marshall, who's utilizing that as his justification to bring forth, inciting the Roman papal bulls issued by popes who sat in the 14th and 15th century as a justification in the 1800s to rule over a jurisdictional and assume jurisdiction and our say over native issues. And so if you trace the citations from the Standing Rock case, what case do you think you're going to find yourself at when you get to the end? John Sidney McIntosh. That is the manner in which the federal court system of today's day and age, at least when it comes to dealing with native issues, is a system that's rigged against us. After you went through a rigged consultation process, you go through a rigged dispute resolution process. And you're to either accept the outcome or put forth an effort to fight in a peaceful and or prayerful manner and bring forth your very will to see what can be done. You're either aware or not aware that today the Corps of Engineers made a decision to deny the easement. The decision that the Corps had made with regard to the easement, where do you think that decision was based upon? What area were they making their determination on as to issue their FONSI, their finding of no significant impact? On each side of the Missouri River, there's a borehole where the pipe is going to enter. Right there and right there. Nothing above river, below river, nothing with regard to the origins of the oil, the destination of the oil, nor any of the impacts that could be felt from the 17 million U.S. citizens who are downriver if there was an incident to happen where it was proposed. So there's a flawed process, collectively. On the way down here, we were traveling, and we stopped at Biggs. Coming from the Yakima Nation, we stopped at Biggs. We stopped, got some drinks for myself, my children, my wife, and we were getting ready to journey on, and we saw a brother standing at the corner. And that brother was Paul. Paul, could you stand up? Paul, can you grab your sign and show me what I saw when I was driving by you? Paul made a determination that he was going to go join his brothers and sisters, the other veterans at Standing Rock. It just so happens to be by chance, on my way to an engagement that's raising funds for Standing Rock, that I drive by Paul. Where I come from, we would never drive past someone like that when they're going over to the stand on behalf of the resources that you love, that you hold dear, that you fight for. So I turned around. I said, you know what, we'll see what can be done. And what I'm going to propose is this. You guys are at a fundraiser for an event. You have a veteran here that wants to go be a part of that event. Yeah. I figure I'll start it. I got $100.
Oh, I'm sure we'll get him there.
This is my right here. Paul, you can bring your hat to me. My son's right here. He's going to walk around the tables with hat to hat. And the reality is that it is not over. Regardless of the decision that had come from the court today. So I don't know how that's going to play out. But I do know this. I think that the veterans and the collective work and the effort that they did, the stand for each of them to come forth and answer their constitutional cause, the right that they had and their feeling in their heart to do that and go be human shields for the water protectors. Because anyone who's seen me advocate and talk or be at certain things knows that most of the time I don't play nice. I'm going to call things for what I deem them to be, say it how it is. And I can tell you right now, whether it's Democrat or Republican, I'm disappointed in everybody. Yeah. Everybody. If we had the time, all right, if we had the time, I'd pull up a computer, we'd have a big screen right here, and we'd look at the political contributions that all parties, all sides have received from Big Oil, from the different fossil fuel industries, and what you're going to find is that'll tell you exactly why there's been so much political silence on this issue.
That's right.
From both sides, including Obama. Take a look at his political contributions and you'll find out exactly where his will, his understanding of where he comes from, why he's doing what he's doing, and where he's going with it. Energy Transfer Partners obviously has got some pretty strong financing behind it. I think everyone's aware. I think there's 26 banks. I think one or two of them have pulled out their financing ever since the controversies ensued. But such a project that has that many zeros behind it isn't going to go away just because a denial of an easement comes forth. And I think the fines, which is probably about $50,000 a day, is a drop in the bucket with regard to a proposal. Well, let's go ahead and just play it out here until the transition of the new administration comes into play, and perhaps there's going to be a reversal with all the decisions that have been made up to today. And that's just the beginning, because they denied the easement, but they also mandated a EIS, an environmental impact statement, which is going to look at alternative routes. But alternative route, which way? Upriver or downriver? Because as far as my math goes, and I'm not a mathematician, but the 17 million residents from all walks of life, U.S. citizens, will be impacted regardless of which way you go, above Standing Rock or below Standing Rock, if there's to be a leak in the Missouri River, which will eventually hit the Mississippi up into the Gulf of Mexico. Not so dissimilar from one another. We are not, in principle, maybe in background, maybe in origin, maybe in whatever it may be, but the very principles upon the positive things in this world that we wish to do and advocate for, that will leave something for our future generations, is simple as this. The ability to drink clean water, breathe clean air, walk upon untainted grounds, and eat untainted food. So hard as it is, where are we going to be 50 years from now? Where are we going to be 100 years from now? Where are our children and our grandchildren going to be? How is their lives going to be? Tonight we come together with an understanding of who we are and what we stand for this evening, where we come from collectively, and the very principles of what we believe in, and where we wish to collectively go. I'm sure many of you in here perhaps can even educate me on the details of a proposal for a Nestle water bottling plant in Cascade Locks.
Yeah.
A methane plant at Kalama, Washington.
Yeah, right.
Tesoro plant here in Vancouver.
Yeah.
All right, the coal plant in Longview.
Yeah.
There has been a very systematic approach and advocacy for a superhighway of fossil fuels to come through the Northwest. We collectively must put our hearts, our minds, and our spirits together to have an understanding of what we can collectively bring forth to combat this advocacy. It is real. There have been projects defeated, but there's so much money behind these projects that they will disappear and reappear under new corporate names, under different shell companies, as was being discussed. Me and Paul were talking about all the way up the river here. You'll probably see me advocating as best as I can. And I'm not afraid to call out whoever it may be with regard to a responsible decision-making process and an advocacy or a justification by the will of which you are coming from. Where are you coming from? Why are you coming here? And where is it collectively taking us? So with that, I appreciate all of you being here tonight. I appreciate all the donations that come to our brother Paul. Perhaps we can make some kind of arrangement. If it's there, we'll get him there. And he can join his brothers and sisters at the front lines at Standing Rock. And so I thank you all this evening.
That's Buffy St. Marie and her classic song, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, following up on excerpts from a keynote talk by Yakima Tribal Chair Jode Gowdy from a December 4th fundraiser for Standing Rock. The event was sponsored by Black Lives Matter in Vancouver, Washington, and it was produced by Old Mole Collective member Desiree Helligers, with special thanks to Cecilia Towner and Robin White. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. Now, here is Jan Hocken to talk with psychoanalyst Lynn Layton about psychoanalytic activism and a group within the American Psychological Association engaged in resistance to the U.S. military and state power.
Welcome to KABU, Lynn Layton.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Well, as a psychoanalyst, you've been involved for a number of years in activism and have written extensively about politics and the psyche. You're also part of a section within the American Psychological Association that's taken up political situations where psychologists have been involved in oppressive practices. We'll be talking later about a recent letter of apology from your organization to American Indian and Alaska Native peoples that grew out of the Standing Rock protests and the events around in early December. But let's start with Section 9 and some of the history of this group within the APA. Tell us about Section 9.
I would be happy to, because it's such an important part of my life and has been for a very long time. The section, I think it's the last section to form within Division 39, which is psychoanalytic psychology, and started around 2000. And we do a number of things. We've had a number of different kinds of definitions of activism, among which are education on social, cultural, social justice issues as they impact doing clinical work or the profession. And we have done more actively protesting kinds of movements within the American Psychological Association.
I think many cable listeners and perhaps feminists and those who identify with progressive politics associate psychoanalysis with a very conservative set of positions. And of course, in the 1950s, when medical schools were dominated by psychoanalysts and they were positioned in prestigious roles in medical schools throughout the country, and psychoanalysis was limited to MDs, it was indeed a very conservative vision of psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
How much is there been a left turn in psychoanalysis, and how do you account for that?
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that the entire profession has made a left turn, but the entire profession is currently an endangered species, from what I gather from different colleagues. What different colleagues have said, something like 70 or 80% of psychology professors in academia are clinical ones, are cognitive behavioral therapists, and there's a lot of contempt, I think, in the current atmosphere for psychoanalysis, some of which may be deserved, some of which not. I think there are parts of the psychoanalytic movement in various countries that are quite radical, and parts that are that continue to be conservative, that universalize the psyche, that still have a concept of the analyst as one who knows. But I think in North America, the relational psychoanalytic movement, or at least a wing of the relational psychoanalytic movement, has been very much concerned with social and cultural issues and with social justice, and has incorporated it into their thinking about how we do therapy, what the position of the therapist is in the room. And in that way, I think ally with other non-psychoanalytic groups that are concerned with oppression.
Well, let's talk a little about the controversy within the American Psychological Association over psychologists' involvement in torture and the report in 2015 that documented the extensive secret collaboration of APA members with the Bush administration around torture practices. Some of the leadership in this campaign to confront APA was organized by, sustained by psychoanalytic clinicians. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little about that campaign?
Yeah.
And whether psychoanalysis brought anything particular to that issue?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think I said what Section 9 is called. So if I didn't, it's Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility. And we were, in fact, very involved in the move to change the APA Code of Ethics, which had allowed psychologists to participate in enhanced interrogations in Black detention sites. We were, along with several other groups, some of them not psychoanalytic, like Psychologists for Social Responsibility, we were involved within APA in a movement to have a referendum to change the ethics code. And we did succeed, but the ethics code was not changed. And that led to some of us in Section 9 and elsewhere continuing to struggle until, fortunately, I think the main link was a New York Times writer, James Risen, picking up the issue, and that led to the APA asking for an independent review. And David Hoffman did that review, and it did indeed find extensive collusion between the Department of Defense and the American Psychological Association staff.
Perhaps the outsider status of psychoanalysis that for the most part does not benefit from defense contracts like many, many psychologists. You know, the VA is the largest employer of psychologists in the U.S. Psychologists depend often on defense contracts. Many of the treatment protocols are funded by the Department of Defense. So perhaps not being listed as an evidence-based treatment, psychoanalytic approaches, maybe there is some affinity then with oppositional forces because the economic interests of psychoanalytic institutes is no longer so aligned with the established elites and the powers that
be. As well, I think, is the fact that we have never been really a symptom-based or medicalized part of the profession. So as that part of the profession takes over more and more, where things are just looked at as discrete in terms of discrete behaviors, and there's no moral or social larger context to think within, I think that the psychodynamic approaches where we are trying to understand what people experience, what the meaning of things, of their problems are.
Not simply eliminating or controlling symptoms, but approaching symptoms as meaningful communications.
What can they tell us? Yes, that we assume that most symptoms actually speak of histories of oppression.
Well, let's turn to the recent letter of apology to Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. I think part of what's important here is the shift from these offshore detention centers, which in some ways are so egregiously immoral, and they don't implicate the everyday work of mental health facilities and institutions in this country. In some ways, it's an easier moral victory. I mean, one hard fought and not easily
hard fought.
But nonetheless, this
over many years.
And without minimizing that fight, there is, it seems to me, a different set of struggles around the everyday institutions of the Indian Health Service, the larger everyday institutions that regulate the lives of oppressed people, and the routines that are less morally outrageous on the face of it. So tell us a little bit about this recent letter of apology and some of the history of it.
Okay. I think that there is the link that I would see between the two movements is our sense of first do no harm. That, to me, links the critique of work being done in these enhanced detention sites and this current letter of apology. So let me tell you a little bit about how it came to be. The Society of Indian Psychologists have been very critical over the last several years of the APA Code of Ethics, and recently asked the APA to issue a letter of apology that would be on the model of the of a letter of apology that the Australian Psychological Association issued to Aboriginal populations and Torres Strait Islanders in, I think it happened in September. And they did not get anywhere with the APA, although they also asked the APA to come out in support of the protesters at Standing Rock, and APA did do that a week or so ago. So one of the members of Section 9, who is part Native American, took up that call from the Society of Indian Psychologists and asked if we would write a letter of apology. So we drew very strongly on the letter of the Australian Psychological Association, and we issued the letter of apology. And again, we're acknowledging in that letter the harm done not only by psychology itself, but also the history of the United States as a settler colonial nation that has been involved and continues to be involved, as you see in this Standing Rock movement, of the boiling of the environment, theft of land. et cetera. And now with the new appointee of Donald Trump to head the Environmental Protection Agency, the issue of first do no harm is really front and center.
The history of apology letters is itself contentious in terms of when these letters carry some weight. The Obama administration and I believe the Clinton administration have issued apologies in the past, including to Native Americans. This seems to go beyond that in also standing in solidarity with the activists at Standing Rock. And then perhaps the question ahead that I think is attached to all of these symbolic statements, when do they really have real meaningful weight beyond the their symbolic role?
Beyond. We didn't just issue this letter. We're following it up in a couple of ways. We're engaged in trying to get other divisions. So we're just a section of Division 39, and we hope that Division 39 will sign on to this letter. And I've been in touch now with several other divisions to try to get as many divisions to sign on as possible. And then we would represent the question to the American Psychological Association if they could endorse this apology. Now, as you say, apologies don't mean very much if there's not some follow-up. And in fact, I actually just came from a meeting in Boston on resistance to surveillance. And a woman from the Black Lives Matter Cambridge movement was talking about how earlier this year there was a meeting of police chiefs, and the police chief from Wellesley, Massachusetts, apologized to African Americans for the harm done by police. Whereas, currently, as we speak, the police chief of Boston is in Israel, sending back communications about the great things they're learning, precisely about surveillance of dissident communities. So she was warning that you have to watch where the apology is coming from and what's the follow-up to the apology.
Before we close, I would also like to have you say a bit about some of the substance of the grievances that Native and Indigenous peoples have had specifically around psychology, because there's a kind of generic all-purpose apology that often doesn't address the specificity of grievances. Can you say a little about that, and what are the specific grounds for the apology?
I think that in part the apology, on a maybe more abstract level, has to do with differences in values of Native populations and current and perhaps historical liberal and neoliberal values. And those values are incorporated in our psychological guidelines, like individualism, as opposed to the respect for collective responsibility. Then there are many things that have been done in United States history to these populations, incarceration, what does it do to a population to have your land and waters poisoned, ongoing intergenerationally transmitted and ongoing traumas that then psychologists treat as if the person who's ill, outside of any social context, as if the person who's ill has this particular disorder and there's no connection with the histories of oppression that have caused some of these symptoms. Our diagnostic systems don't really take into account Native cultural belief systems and worldviews, and our assessment techniques too. So there are many things. There's the treatment, the assessment, the diagnosis that I think would need to be re-looked at, and this is what the Society of Indian Psychologists have written several communiques critiquing APA ethical guidelines for how they do not take into account the realities of Native populations.
And you're also calling for a broader social therapeutics and a redistribution of moral responsibility for the trauma suffered by Native and Indigenous communities. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Lynn Layton, psychoanalyst, author, and active member of the Section 9 Psychoanalysis for Social Responsibility within the American Psychological Association. Thanks so much for being with us today, Lynn.
Thank you.
No necesito documentos. Mírame a los ojos para que leas mi acento. Prohibido como la droga, contraindicado, clandestino. Lo identificable, lo contamino. Más de 600 millones de personas gritando luz.
And that's more from Outer National's song, Todos Somos Ilegales, or We Are All Illegal. Here's a translation of those last lines. I don't need documents. Look me in the eye to read my accent. Prohibited like drugs, contraindicated, clandestine, the unidentifiable, the contaminated. More than 600 million people demanding the green light to invade Arizona. And just before the music, we heard the Old Moles' Jan Hocken talking with Lynn Layton about psychoanalysis and the law, about how the problems that can drive people crazy and maybe into therapy are not really their personal problems, but problems with the fit between human freedom and human needs on the one hand, and the legalized systems of oppression that deny that freedom and those needs on the other. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I have more to say about what today's Old Mole, as well as last week's, suggests about the vision and organization we need not only to resist Trump and Trumpism, but to build a far better society in which demagogues could find no place.
Now is the time for us to shuffle off the coil of mourning, shocked surprise, and anger at the election of Donald Trump as president. And as Todd Sloan pointed out on this program last week, it's also time to leave behind the fine-grained analysis of what went wrong in an attempt to locate the one or two things we might be able to fix. There was a multitude of interwoven factors and no single place to point the finger of blame. It's time to talk about what we do now. How do we respond to the coming barrage of attacks on civil liberties, including even the right to protest? How do we challenge the unraveling of environmental protections and rolling back of progress on climate change, the undermining of social services, not only programs for the very poor like Medicaid and welfare, but sources of support that keep the rest of us out of poverty, like Social Security and Medicare? The further privatization of public goods like schools, the post office, and increases in policing, criminalization, and profit-driven incarceration. And how do we respond to the demonization and harassment of Latinos and Muslims that is already underway, and to the plans for criminalization and mass deportations, and so on? Now, people often disempower themselves when faced by questions like these by asking, what can I as an individual do? And of course, the answer to that is very little. I can write letters, sign petitions, post and like things on Facebook, and plan to vote for better candidates in 2 years and in 4 years, but we know how futile such solitary actions can seem. But we are not alone. We are not first and foremost single and separate individuals. We can and must act together. One way to do this is by turning out for demonstrations, marches, and rallies. When we do this, we become part of something larger than ourselves. We feel ourselves to be an embodiment of the people who, when united, will never be defeated. Here in Portland and in other cities around the country, there have been massive protests against Trump and Trumpism. These crowds express powerful feelings of solidarity that are essential to effective political action, a solidarity that empowers us far beyond what any of us can do as individuals alone in our private spaces. But unless this energy is organized and develops a sense of direction, it does not last. People fall back into their habitual isolation, living, working, and consuming as mere individuals, related to each other only through the cash nexus, that is, by buying and selling. Organizations are, in fact, forming. Talking with the Old Mole's Denise Morris last week, Stephanie Luce remarked,
I mean, I think the protests are healthy. They're part of democracy, but there's all kinds of organizing work going on alongside that. Reports are coming in from around the country of emergency community meetings that are overflow crowds, 500 people, 1,000 people showing up in their neighborhoods to talk about next steps. organizations getting thousands of new members signing up, coming to meetings, money flowing in to campaign issues. So I'm encouraged by the fact that it's protests are good, one thing, but it's not stopping there. People are also building the infrastructure they need to go forward.
And as an example today, we heard earlier on the Old Mole voices from the movement at Standing Rock that has succeeded in blocking, at least for now, the Dakota Access Pipeline, an action involving many thousands working together in focused, coordinated solidarity. That coordinated crowd of activists illustrates what we just heard Lynn Layton call the Native American respect for collective responsibility, in contrast with the individualism, the everyone for oneself mentality that is baked into our identity in neoliberalism. The first order of business for a resurgent and organizing left is resistance, the defense and protection of people who are being set up as victims by the new regime: immigrants, Muslims, Latinos, African Americans, women, dissidents, and members of the LGBTQ community. But if we limit our objectives to resistance, we are letting the existing order of things off the hook. It was the way things are now, and as they have been for a long time, that created the complex of factors that produced the phenomenon of Trump. Even if Trump had lost to Hillary Clinton, wages for working people would still be stagnating, public services decaying, and the U.S. military would still be waging overt and covert wars around the world. We need an alternative vision of a good tomorrow, not just resistance against an impending catastrophe. That good future we envision must be far more than just a better regulated version of the existing order of things, for what lies at the foundation of that order is the right of private individuals to control the social wealth we all depend upon for life. As long as the institutions that we must work for in order to live, the institutions that produce the goods and services and means of education and communication that define our lives, as long as these institutions are managed in ways to maximize the profit and power of the very wealthy, any partial gains we make by taxing and regulating the rich will always be fragile and reversible. It is we, the people united, not only in the streets, but everywhere we are, who must become energized, organized, and dedicated to the project of replacing the private power of wealth with the public power of the people. Perhaps as it dawns on us that it is the system of private ownership that has reached its apotheosis in Trumpism, then the political energy now arising in protest may be able to find its focus in the goal of eliminating the system that has made Trumpism possible. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thanks to Bill Resnick and Ashley Ailes for their discussion of the challenges facing civil rights attorneys in the Trump era, to Desiree Hellegers for her recording of Jode Gowdy's keynote speech about the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and to Jan Hocken and Lynn Layton for their discussion of psychoanalysis and the politics of psychology. Tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's underground point of view. I'm Clayton Morgeridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg.